Hi, I'm Gilbert, an alcoholic. Hi, Gilbert. And thank you for inviting me here. I'll get the statistics out of the way first. I'm a 57-year-old gay Mexican alcoholic. Okay. And my sponsor's name is Mark A., and I sponsor, I sometimes lose track, Arlene, Sonia, Shannon, David, Charlie, Jimmy, and I know I'm missing one. Patrick, good old Patrick, of course. And those are my sponsees. And Ken, oh, Lord. And there's a waiting list. I also sponsor two cats, Faraon and Ariel. I've been sober since the 3rd of January, 1980. So I just celebrated 33 years of continuous sobriety. And and that sort of kicks my ass even saying it, because that's kind of a short lifetime when you think of it. And I was so young when I came here. And I had hair. And now I don't. And I'm not so young, except maybe at heart. And I don't know, I think my family wasn't quite ready for me when I was born. You know, I was a creative child. And I used to do quirky things. And like I would climb trees and you know, and bring up a sheet and tear it up and pretend to be a cloud. And my mom tells a story that one time she went to get the mop in the patio, and I had put curlers in the mop. And then she said, "Why did you put curlers in the mop?" Because they were her curlers. And I said, "Well, it's ugly. It's just ugly." And so she laughed, and I think she got the story from that moment on. And then my father tells a story that when I was like five, I used to have a swing set in the backyard, and he was on a chaise lounge, which was something big that, you know, men did in the 60s. I don't know, something about having a chaise lounge in the backyard was, you know, cool. And so I was swinging by myself, and a thought occurred to me, so I jumped off the swing, and I ran over, and I punched him in the stomach. And then he looked at me, and he said, "What is it?" And I said, "We are born only to die." And then I went back to the swing, and I swung for the rest of the afternoon because I had, you know, had this thought. And that's kind of unusual for a five-year-old, but it kind of indicates my mindset, you know. I'm by nature a very curious kind of person, you know, not curious in a peculiar runaway kind of way, but I like to learn new things and to know more. And I think that streak inside me has kept me going in a lot of different ways, through hard times and through you know, the travails that is sobriety in life. And you know, as I look back at it now, I had a very loving family. They weren't just tolerant; they were accepting, and they appreciated who I was. My father had plans for me to go to college from the crib on, and so. So I felt this pressure all the time to be a good student, and I excelled in school, and I didn't speak English until I was six. And so, wow. And so I kind of went that route. Should I wait? I don't know. And the deal was that, you know, when I turned into an adolescent, when I became 13, I understood very fully that I'm gay. And I didn't want that. And so I think from that moment on, I wanted somehow to hide that fact. And when I was 14 years old, I had my first drink at my godmother's house. They were having a party. And my first drink was a half gallon of Tyrolean wine, which was like kind of like Kool-Aid with a little bit of a kick. And I drank the whole thing. And I got very drunk and very Nelly. And I threw up in the rose bush. And I loved it. I loved it. And I couldn't wait to do it again, even though the next morning I was still sick and I was hurting. I knew that I'd found it. I'd found that thing that relieved me of me. And I don't think I'm unusual in that regard. You know, it's all of my brothers are alcoholic. All of them. And And through my teenage years, I used to hang out with my brother Bob, who drank and took drugs profusely. I used to help him, commit burglaries. And because I was so skinny at the time, he would throw me over the window, and I would go to the front door and open up the door. And then he and my cousins would walk in, and I'd wait in the car. And I thought I wasn't a criminal because I was waiting in the car while they were doing their business. And then they'd come back with whatever they had, and we'd leave. And of course, I was always drunk or high. And you know, I don't know about you, but when I drank, there was no moral compass. I just did whatever was exciting or whatever I could do to be accepted. And I didn't even think about the wrong things that I was doing. It just occurred to me that I did it while drunk, and that was okay. Somehow that absolved me of any responsibility. I was drunk, so what? And there was this other part of me, though, that wanted to be better, to be a good man, a good person. So I studied very hard, and I won a full scholarship to Pitzer College in Claremont, and I went off to this really elegant school to become a psychologist. And it worked out for a while, but, you know, I still was drinking, and then I was introduced to drugs at college. And eventually, I had my first suicide attempt. And I heard somebody call me a queer at a party, and I got so upset about it that the next day I got a razor blade, and I cut my arms 26 times. I didn't realize it, but somebody had dotted the speed with mescaline, and I had these hallucinations, and I was writing the word goodbye in my blood above the bed, but I passed out, and everyone thought I wrote God, but I was really writing goodbye, but with bad punctuation, you know, and they took me to the hospital, and the nurses kept saying, "This is the worst I've ever seen in this college." And I thought, "I don't care," because my real thought was, "I can't even do this right. I've screwed up again." And so then I went to one of my professors, and I was very depressed. And she said, "Well, what? Because we should do something for you, Gilbert. Tell me one thing in your life that you've always wanted to do, and I can see if I can help you." And I said, "Well, you know, I love the Beatles, and I've always wanted to go to Liverpool." So she arranged it for me to go to Oxford for a semester. And so when I was 19, and I weighed 130 pounds then, you know, I had really thick brown hair and, you know, my skin. I looked like a brown Q-tip, you know. And so off I went at Oxford to read Thomas Hardy, you know, because they do tutorials at Oxford. I don't know if you know the system, but I went to go read about Thomas Hardy, and I did that for a semester, and I did well at that, but I was still drinking. And the irony was that I had been arrested about 3 weeks, no, actually it was about 3 months before I went to Oxford. I got arrested for petty theft. I was with my brother, high on speed and beer, and I stole a Mata Hoople album and a bag of socks at a Kmart in West Covina. Always the style beacon, you know. And I was arrested, and I was put on probation. And then my PO told me, I can't let you go out of state because you're still on probation. You have 6 months to go. So I was very depressed, and so he sent me to court. And I went into the courtroom, and the judge says, "Well, what do you want? I said, "I want to leave the state to go study." And he says, "Well, where are you studying?" And I said, "Lincoln College, Oxford." And he just laughed at me. And then he looked at the letter and said, "Oh, just get out of here." And so he gave me permission to leave. And so off I went. And, of course, the entire time I was at school, I was drunk there. And I came back home, and I thought, well, I'll have this new resolve, and I'll go back to school, and I'll apply myself. And I graduated with honors at Pitzer. And I won a fellowship to study at Brown University, which is in the Ivy League. Sometimes they don't. And I was the Brown Fellow in American Civilization. And I was going to go read Theodore Dreiser. I had this thing about men and writers. And needless to say, I took me with me. I got a master's degree only. I was supposed to get a PhD, but I drank my way out of the program. They invited me to leave. They don't tell you to get out. They just invite you to leave. I don't know what the difference is, but I had to go. You know, and then I have to remember that, you know, at St. Patrick's Day, I got drunk at a party, and I decided I want to end my life, and so I tried to throw myself out of a bathroom window rear end first. And I broke the glass with my butt, and then I pushed myself over, but I didn't realize it, but there was a radiator there, and my boot had a long boot. It got caught on the radiator knob, and I dangled three stories up. And I looked down at the snow, because it was very wintry then, and I thought, I might fall. And by this time, they broke in the door, and they pulled me in, and they're screaming, Gilbert, Gilbert, don't kick, because I, you know, I could have fallen to my death. And then I was in the living room the next moment, and at this party where these Japanese students would come to America to see what American students were like. And I cried in this guy named Katsuhito's lap for 3 hours, just sobbing, I'm so sad, you don't understand. And he didn't speak any English, so he just kind of said, yeah, yeah. And the next morning, I was at a psychiatrist's office, and I told him my tale of woe about my drinking and my isolation and my inner pain, my angst. And he said, well, you know, it sounds like you have a drinking problem, Mr. Valadez. And I said, oh? He said, well, you know, I said, maybe. And he said, well, if you have a drinking problem, why don't you go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? We have them on campus. And I think it would be beneficial to you. And I thought for a moment, you know, and I don't know about you, but there's always a lie on hold. I always have lies on hold. And my lie on hold that moment was, well, it's not that bad. And I really believed it. I really thought that it wasn't that bad. You know, even though I tried to take my life the night before and dangled three stories up, it was still kind of okay to drink. And one thing led to another, and eventually I took the master's and ran. And in the interim, I got peritonitis, and I didn't treat it because I thought it was just a hangover. And I ended up in a hospital for about a month in the ICU, actually. And I'd lost a lot of weight. I weighed like 125 pounds when I got out of the hospital. When I flew back to L.A., my parents bought me a ticket to come home. My mom saw me at the airport, and she just started wailing because I looked so bad. And I just felt defeated one more time, a total loser. And, oh, well. So, you know, I tried to regroup. And somebody, I was looking for work, and I went to this employee development office, and I said, I don't know what to do for work. And I gave her this resume of my credentials, and she said, well, with this background, why don't you teach? And I didn't want to be a teacher because I thought it was so lowbrow. You know, that. And I said, well, okay. And so I applied for a credential program in Claremont because I knew people there. And I got into a teacher preparation program to teach elementary school. And I got good grades, and I was getting my credential. And I got my first teaching job in 1979 in September. But by that time, I was so out of it. I was exhausted, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, all of it. I was burnt. And I would get drunk and wander the neighborhood with nothing on except my pants at 1 in the morning. And I lived across the street from the school where I taught. And it never occurred to me that if someone saw me doing that, they might not want to keep me unemployed anymore. You know? I remember once I was so drunk, I broke into the classroom where I taught. I climbed the fence and broke into my class and just passed out there. It was the weekend. They didn't find me. But it was insane. It was insane. It was insane. And my last drunk was on the New Year's Eve, the 2nd of January, 1980. And I'd gone to my friend's house to watch a movie, The Discreet Charm of Bourgeoisie. And she gave me a scotch, and we sat there drinking the scotch, and then she gave me my belated Christmas present. It was a box of wine. White wine, a rosé, and two reds. I know exactly what they were. And I got home, and I didn't have a, a corkscrew, so I got a screwdriver and just went thump. And then I poured, you know, this glass of wine, and I blacked out. I came to the next morning in the bathroom floor. I'd been running while vomiting, and I fell face first, and I pulled the towel rack off with my right arm and hit the toilet with my head. I was in total agony with my head throbbing and feeling mortified again, because why did I do this last night? I wanted to save that wine. I thought, you know, for a special occasion. And but then I looked and thought, you know, somebody must have come in and beaten me up. So I got up and I went to the front door, and of course it was locked from the inside. And I thought, boy, he was good. So then I thought about the wine, and I went into the kitchen, and the bottles were gone. There were four empty bottles on the counter. And then I had gone in a blackout and bought a pint of Southern Comfort and a quart of Rainier Ale, which I think they use to clean barges or something. It's like, it's only technically alcohol. And that scared me for some reason. I thought, wow, in one night I had a scotch and all that crap. No wonder I got sick. So I went about collecting the empties, and I found like 80 beer cans, 25 bottles of wine, you know, because I was already taken to buying 88-cent bottles of wine at the Pick and Save, you know, it's the epitome of class always. And in fact, I would go to the store and buy like six of them at a time, and I would tell the lady at the check stand, you know, I'm making chicken. And then she said, well, you must eat a lot of chicken, honey, because you did that 2 days ago. And I thought, what a bitch. And I gave her my money and went home. And so I took my empties to the Dipsy dumpster behind my apartment, and I flung them over the can, and it was empty. It was trash day, so it was completely empty. So all of the broken glass and the cans just tingled on the side of this Dipsy dumpster. And I thought, wow. And then I turned around, the landlord and the gardener were standing directly behind me. And so, you know, I had a lie in waiting, or a scheme in waiting, and the scheme was, pretend nothing happens. It's okay. He didn't hear that. And so I walked past him, you know, or slumped by or whatever. And I heard him say, the landlord to the gardener, well, never mind him, he's just an alcoholic. And I don't know if he said it, but I heard it. It makes sense. It was like my conscience or something said, that's really true. For all the lies in waiting, there's this huge truth waiting to pounce like some tiger in the darkness. And that tiger leapt at me and took hold of me, and I could not deny it anymore. Either you do something about this or you will die, was what I said to myself. And, you know, in melodramatic flair, I went and cried on the sofa. And I'd seen the movie Come Back, Little Sheba 4 times. And I know that when you go to AA, you call up Alcoholics Anonymous, and someone in a dark Chrysler will come and take you to your first meeting, probably in a basement. They'll all have really dingy raincoats, and they'll just be this purgatory of shame for the rest of your life. Suffer! And so I called. And, you know, even at that, I didn't want it. I was just being melodramatic. And I called up central office, and they said, what do you want? And I said, I need to go to a meeting. I came to on the bathroom floor this morning. I was covered in vomit. I don't know what to do. They said, hold on. And so they did all this. I don't know what they were doing. I guess connecting me to different people. And I was connected to a man named John. And he said, because my name is John, I'm an alcoholic. And who are you? And I said, I'm Gilbert. And he said, are you alcoholic, Gilbert? I said, I don't know. I don't know. I knew. And And then we talked for a long time. It must have been a couple of hours. And peppered through this conversation was, you want to go to a meeting? No. And I'd talk some more. Because I thought it was like cheap counseling, you know, easy does it. And I said, no. And he kept asking me and kept asking me. And then finally he said, well, do you want to go to a meeting? I said, no. And then he said, I guess he was getting fed up. And he said, well, why? Why, Gilbert? Why don't you want to go? I said, well, you know, I had a line waiting. I said, well, I'm too young. I'm 24 years old. You know, I'm just too young. I mean, I know that there are a lot of old people in those meetings. I can't relate. And he was quiet. He said, well, you know, we have a young people's group in Upland that meets tomorrow night. You know, and those kids are anywhere from 12 to 29 years old. You can go to that meeting. There are plenty of young people. I said, oh. So you want to go to a meeting? No. Well, why? I said, well, I'm Mexican. And I know that AA is largely Caucasian. You know, based on a 19th century ideal of Christianity. I cannot deal with it. And he said, well, you know, in Pomona, we have Spanish-speaking meetings 3 times a week. And I think there are Mexicans there. So I said, oh. And of course, do you want to go to a meeting? No. You guys know this story. Well, why not? This was the worst one. This is the one I'm still embarrassed about this one. Well, I'm too educated for AA. I said, well, really? I said, yeah, I just finished a master's at Brown. I have a BA in English and psychology. I was the Brown Fellow in American Studies. You know, I'm a teacher now. I just won't relate to people in AA. And he said, oh. I said, well, I have a PhD from MIT. And then I said, oh. What's your field of endeavor? What did you study? Organic chemistry. Which, you know, if you're a chemist, that's the hardest chemistry there is. It's not like the Barbizon School of Chemistry, okay? You don't apply by filling out a matchbook cover. And MIT, it has, you know, one of the best in the country and throughout the world. So there was Dr. John on the other end. And I just lost it. I just started crying. And I said, well, why do you do this? Why are you doing this? Why are you talking to me? You know, this has like been 3 hours of this crap. Right? He must have been like a saint, like Christ. And he said, well, I'm on a dialysis machine. I have to be on this machine every day, because if I don't, I will die. And rather than waste my time on this machine, I take calls from AA. You know, like, and sometimes your selfishness slaps you in the face like the bitch you are. Shut up! And I could not fathom this thing. I couldn't see somebody on a machine saving his life thinking that helping this selfish little boy was more important than that. That didn't make any sense to me. And I thought, well, if he can do that, if he can be like that, maybe I should go to a meeting. You know, brave man that I am. And so he said, do you want to go to a meeting? Yes. I want to go. And he was so happy. He was like, oh, yes, you're a miracle. You're a miracle. Oh, Gilbert! Right. So he knew not to trust me to go alone. I'm sending two guys to get you tonight. And so I said, okay. And I gave my address. I don't even know if that's kosher anymore, but they did that. So off, I gave my address, and I'll be there 6 sharp. And I made the important decision. What do I wear? And I wore a pair of Sergio Valenti jeans. Do you remember those? A Pierre Cardin shirt. These killer topsiders. I was still very twee in those days. Still, the effect of brown hadn't worn off yet. And I waited. And, you know, and I was looking for the dark Chrysler out the window. And this orange Pinto arrived. And this guy, if I remember, his name was Sean. He had a Black Sabbath T-shirt on. And who are you? I'm Gilbert. Well, I'm here to take you to a meeting, Gilbert. And I went, oh, you know, and he must have been like 18 years old, dripping wet, you know. And even then, every fiber in my body says, I do not want to go. And I got into the car, you know, and this is very prim, and watching these guys listening to Def Leppard all the way. And I got to the meeting, and the first meeting was at the Triangle Club in Pomona. And in those days, they used to put sawdust on the floor so the men could spit. I thought, charming. My real thought was, this is what it's come to. That was worse than the dark basement. And this woman named Bobby, who she looked like a waitress in that Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore movie, you know that? She had a doily with a name on it, Bobby with an I. This bouffant hairdo, you know, real high hair, bright red. And the men loved her, and the women hated her because she slept with all the men. And she said, hey, honey, what are you doing here? And I said, you must be new. And I said, and she took me by the hand, and I was just too defenseless. I didn't care anymore. Said, yeah, whatever. She sat me in the very front row, and the speakers came up, and, you know, and I had made up my mind, I'm going to get home. I'm going to get to that liquor store. I'm going to get drunk. This is bullshit. And then they spoke, and then the last speaker came up, and his name is Dana C., and I still remember him. There's a line, do you believe in the Beatles song, with Help My Friends, do you believe in a love at first sight? Yes, I'm certain that happens all the time. And I had a love at first sight. I wasn't in love with Dana. I was in love with what he said and what he represented, because he told my story, and I heard this man, and he was in a beautiful Yves Saint Laurent suit. I noticed things like that. And shocking white hair. He was from Sweden. But he just spoke from his heart, and it felt so true to me. Again, it was like, you know, the tiger of truth had pulled away, and and my wounds began to heal. And I haven't had a drink since. Nothing is better than sobriety. Nothing. Because I'm sober, I live a very passionate and powerful life. And people who know me, you know, I have friends here from like tonight. I can't tell you. I have friends from the Wii group, from Drunks Only, from the Fourth Dimensions, from the Live and Let Live Alano Club, Sober Nooners, and my home group, North Park Men's. I mean, there are people here from all those meetings that came out to see me. And I didn't have that before. In the 33 years I've been sober, I've lived a real life. You know, I'm still a teacher. Like 18 years ago, I finished my PhD. And I left. I used to teach kindergarten and first grade. I was a bilingual kindergarten teacher. And I now am a teacher trainer at a university. I'm an associate professor. And like in a couple weeks ago, I had a publication accepted. And then a week later, I was asked to write a chapter in a book on Hispanic serving schools and what to do for lesbian and gay and transgendered and bisexual. I can't keep up with all the issues. I mean, you know, people eat poop, all that. You know, it's like all those acronyms. And I'm going to write a chapter that's going to go into a book eventually. I graduated at USF with an award. I won the Outstanding Dissertation Award. And I got to walk up, and my mom and my sister were in the front row, like Brian and Sonia are and Jimmy right now. And I was able to walk across that stage and get my doctorate with them, you know, sitting there, because I got special tickets for them to be up front for winning the award. You know, so there's payback in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had taken so much from the world when I came here. I didn't realize how selfish I was. And AA has taught me about giving. That's what AA is. It's giving. And the tools that we have in the steps are all about helping the other alcoholic who still suffers. That's giving. Because as I stay sober, I have more to offer. I felt worthless coming into AA. Absolutely worthless. And today, I have worth. I'm worthy. I'm loved. You know, you can overcome many things in AA. You know, I started my membership in North Park Men's years ago because I was kind of ostracized in the gay groups because I'd been diagnosed with AIDS. And I was very, very sick physically. And I was 130 pounds and I had Kaposi sarcoma, so there were lesions all over my body. You know, sometimes I couldn't eat it because I'd vomit. The minute I'd put something down, I'd throw up. And I felt as lonely as I've ever had in AA. But, you know, those men, were so good to me. They watched me cry and get angry. And none of them ever said, go away. You know, I've made them angry at me, sometimes justifiably. But, you know, it's about giving. I learned in North Park Men's that part of giving sometimes is accepting help. They had something to give me, and I let them give it to me. Who knew? And so, you know, I want to end with the fact that, you know, now that I'm, you know, in my 34th year, let me say that. I do count years. I shared last night at my home group about, lately I'm just in the mood to find beauty. You know, I get up and I make a decision that I'm going to go see something beautiful today. And I train teachers, and so I have this group that I've been working with for a year, and their first semester is over, and they're in their second semester, this cohort of young ladies. There are 17 of them, 20-somethings. I mean, they're knockout mice. I mean, God, I wish I were straight because I'd be in hog heaven, you know. But they're just so pretty, and they're beautiful women. And they said, "Welcome back, Dr. V. We missed you." And I knew they meant it. And I sat down and we did our thing about, you know, cognitive process and assessment strategies and all the things that we talk about in that really dry class. And for lunch, they broke up. When I was eating my lunch, and one of the girls said, "You know, I used to study hula when I was at Cal State San Luis Obispo." And the other girl said, "Well, can you teach us how to dance?" And so she said, "Okay." And so she got up. And she went to the side of the room, and it was directly in my field of vision. I could see them like I'm looking at you. And then she did this, you know. And then all the other girls were going, and almost fell off. And then, almost like magic, they were in sync. All of them were like undulating waves, just together. And I videotaped him with my iPhone. Yes, there's an app for that. I taped him for about a minute, and then I immediately put it on our course shell, and I said, "You know, if you guys want to look at yourself dancing, just click on that link, and you'll see yourselves dancing." And I realized sitting there watching them that in that moment that it was just like when I used to teach 5-year-old kids that. One of the reasons I feel I'm a good teacher, effective, is I have this way of making the classroom like a home, like a place where you can't be afraid to explore something new, to stretch your knowledge, to be not afraid to learn more. Because just like that little boy in a tree pretending to be a cloud, there's something tremendously beautiful about wanting to learn, to be more. You know, and AA is the same way. You come here, and all of you have come here to learn. You're stretching your knowledge. You have something to learn. And we can teach you. Every one of you is a teacher. Every one of you is a student. And you're all drunks. Sloppy, creepy, psychotic. My peeps. I listen to your stories, it's like watching a home movie. I mean, come on. And what better place to be, you know? And I can't tell you how beautiful this is. I can't tell you because you already know. Let yourself be beautiful in this sobriety, all of you. And I'm not so alone anymore. You know, I have my friends. Some of whom I sponsor, some of whom sponsor me. And thank goodness for that. So if you're new, please keep coming back. Don't ever feel like you don't belong, because you do. So thank you.